Marshall, please call the next case.
Now calling A24-0001, Tesfaye Shakir, respondent, versus Eric Halverson et al., appellants.
Counsel, as you may recall, you'll each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. The podium at the center does move up and down. There is a clock there as well, so you can keep track of your time. And we would just ask that at the beginning of your argument, you introduce yourself and identify who your client is and whether there are any specific pronunciations, et cetera, we need to know. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Nathan Hansen. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Eric Halverson. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. We're here on appeal today. First of all, it said et al. For appellants, there's only one appellant. This case is a case from a remand prior. His brother was included before this court took the brother out of the case.
We dismissed him.
Dismissed him, that's right.
Sounds like we're quite rough.
He's dismissed out of the case. So on the remand, we had a remand for the issue of damages, and this court said, find the date of the breach and then the amount of the damages. So the case was remanded to the trial court in Ramsey County, and then it kind of bounced around there for a while about what should be done with it and how this issue of damages should be handled. The perspective that the appellant took was that, well, let's explore the issue of damages. It doesn't seem like the record for the trial below was sufficient for damages. And so we started exploring in discovery, just in the interest of defending against whatever damages might be claimed, what kind of things and evidence would tend to demonstrate damages or not. So we requested tax returns and what we got was information was that a different entity that we'd never heard of had operated this business. And I think that the findings of the trial court here where she says that the findings that she makes a finding about this BCT Inc., which is another entity we'd never heard of before, was a pass-through entity and he claimed it on his tax returns. And therefore, it wasn't really... Maybe it didn't go to standing, but it didn't really matter as to damages either. Well, if you're in a position where you need to reconstruct what the value of a business was, there's ways that you would go about doing that. You would look at inventory. You would look at bank accounts. You would look at equipment. You would look at tax returns to see what it had earned over time.
Can I ask you about that, though? So, I mean, some of the things you're naming, inventory, right, that's included in the assets for the purchase price of the business, right? I mean, why shouldn't we accept your counterpart's argument that what you're really asking us to do is to reweigh the evidence? It may not have been great evidence because it wasn't near the time of the breach, but it is some evidence as to value of the assets, which are included in...
It's a good question.
Listing, you know?
That's a good question. What happened to the inventory then? There's nothing in the rec. What happened to the inventory and equipment? If it had all that value, what happened to it? Did my client's leaking roof at some point, did that cause the complete dissipation or destruction or elimination or theft or whatever of the equipment? What happened to it? Did my client do something that caused it to have absolute zero value? whatever equipment was there, which we don't know what it was, and we don't have any evidence about what equipment was allegedly destroyed. So presumably, if you're measuring damages, that would be a very important, another important question to ask would be, what was the value of the diminution of the equipment, or what happened to the equipment? Did the guy sell the equipment? Did BCT Inc. sell the equipment? What was the relationship between, other than what he says in an affidavit, what was the relationship between BCT Inc. and the respondents in this matter? We don't know any of that. On remand, so this question of whether or not the record was open, I think it's clear. The record was open. The judge makes a finding about BCT Inc. So then you're talking about who has the burden. Now, if you take a belt and suspenders approach, you try to explore this from at least the side we did, which is try to look into it so we could defend ourselves. But the side that really had the burden to carry, to prove damages on remand, was the respondent. Was the respondent in this case. And they didn't do any of that. What you would do, I mean, the judge was very open about whatever could be considered. She took out, you know, the stuff that, if the record was open, you could get tax returns, inventory, pictures of things, explanations of what happened to things. I had some sort of equipment, and I was only able to sell it for X amount of money.
You would ask for an offset if there was some value recouped by selling off those assets.
Sure, there would. Yeah, you would. Well, you would have gone into some sort of inquiry about what happened with this, because it doesn't. You don't have something where you buy something. The name wasn't all. Whatever he purchased wasn't all goodwill. I mean, there was presumably equipment, inventory. Who knows what else? And
was there an itemized list of what the original assets of the business?
No.
Were?
This
business is worth $136,000 or
yes,
whatever it was.
The amount of the damages that he initially, the only document that they submitted at trial, at the initial trial of it, was like a handwritten document about what he thought his damages were. I mean, that the respondent had written by hand. If you were going to build this case, I mean, build it up. I mean, it's a big money case. I mean, and then especially on remand, take the opportunity to do it. Now is your chance. It's open. Get your tax returns out. Tell us what BCT Inc. is. Tell us what the inventory is. Tell us what you did with the equipment. This would have been, it was completely wide open to do that, and that wasn't done. Instead, we just went back to the, we just want the full value of the business. It went, because we had a leaky roof, it went from $135,000 or something to zero. And there's really nothing to substantiate that anywhere in the record. There's no mitigation or offset for it.
But on the end, in order to win, do you have to persuade us that there's no evidence in the record to support her award? I mean, there is something in the record where this number comes from, and so why, to go back to the reweighing?
The evidence is offered is just that value of the business. The purchase price of the business. So that's the number. That's the number we got. Well, you can't get from that number to zero. If the number would have been, presumably, that number, maybe they bought more stuff, maybe they had increased the value of it, maybe they said, I bought a new something, and that was a really valuable, and I lost that, or it's just the stuff I had, and then it was worth nothing, and this is what happened to it. We don't know any of that. Nothing at all. So then So the time to do that would have been your full opportunity to do it on remand. So you could have, the judge would have taken any testimony for what it's worth. Contrary, I mean.
But perhaps they decided that their strategy was going to be to say, look, we have this purchase agreement. It establishes the price and the value of the business here, and we're going to rest on that. And why isn't that enough? Why should we find that there's clear error, essentially, in that finding of fact by the district court?
because it wasn't sufficient for this court before. It was remanded. We basically got the same decision that we got prior to remand, subsequent to remand. So if the record was open, you build it up. There's a lot of things you could have done. You could have gotten economic experts, which if they would have produced documents and done it, they could have done that. They could have produced QuickBooks or asset inventories or corporate records, something to build up the damages case. Because maybe it was more, maybe it was less. We don't know. So then the punishment for not doing that is you didn't prove your damages, so you get zero. Because the chance was there. They've already had a chance to do it.
So, Mr. Hansen, on remand, the instructions were in part to determine when the breach occurred, which the district court did do, and then to also value the business post-breach, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And so, you know, obviously we have the figure that preceded the breach, the purchase price. What evidence is in the record with respect to post-breach value?
Nothing. There is nothing about the post-breach value. There's no testimony about it. I bought this. I sold that. I was doing this. I switched to this type of business or that. I installed this. I started doing this type of sales or stopped doing this type of sales. There's simply nothing in the record that supports this conclusion. In essence, it's the same conclusion that we got that we got at the trial court that was remanded. In addition to that, this thing about this BCT Inc., I mean, this should have been fleshed out a little bit better about what was going on with this, because we don't know what the relationship was. He says it was a pass-through entity and it was operating it. Well, did it acquire the inventory, some of the inventory? Was it just, did it buy the assets? What did it pay for them? What consideration did BCT Inc. get in exchange for operating the business? We don't know any of these things. All of these things would have been informative on this issue of damages.
Do you take issue with the district court's conclusion that respondent was forced to vacate the property in 2019? That's undisputed, right?
The respondent pled constructive eviction, and then that constructive eviction claim got dismissed. And then the court said that you could plead that as an affirmative defense.
So you do dispute any implicit factual finding. I mean, this kind of appears in the conclusion of law, but you would dispute any implicit factual finding that the respondent was forced to vacate the property in 2019.
Yeah, that would have been a reversal. The court would have been reversing its prior decision there. It would have said, well, we're resurrecting this constructive eviction claim, because that's what constructive eviction is that he was forced to vacate it. There is no...
I ask because I take from Judge Holbrook's question, you know, it may seem that your stronger argument, because there's some evidence in the record as to the pre-breach value, and you may disagree with the weight of that because it's not near the time of the breach, but, you know, you're arguing there's no evidence about the post-breach value being zero. But I take it from the district court's order, the district court tied the zero to the forced vacation of the property, the respondent needed to leave the property. They can't operate their business, therefore there's no value in the business.
And that was a claim that the court dismissed on summary judgment. So to the extent that we're talking about, that was gone. There was no indication. I mean, if somebody were to buy that business at that point, so you say, well, I have this, I think they're, I guess with you think of things where people somebody will buy anything, it's always just a matter of price. Now, I think in some circumstances that's not true if somebody has toxic waste or something like that. But presumably the question would be what in the condition of that whatever the roof was or whatever was going on with it at that time, what was the value of the business? It wasn't, presumably there would be somebody that might be interested in it. Maybe it would be a very small amount of money. Maybe they would not be satisfied with the amount of money. But it would be some amount of money, provided it wasn't a toxic waste site or something that had negative value that you had to pay to get rid of. There's no indication in the record there was something that somebody would have to pay to get rid of. There was equipment that had some value. There's no testimony about any damage to any equipment that had value.
I have a procedural question, because I was just looking back at the court's order on remand, and this hadn't struck me earlier, but so you brought a motion for summary judgment.
Yes.
And that is what triggered that hearing on remand. So you were taking the position then that there were no issues of material fact and that this could be resolved as a matter of law. And yet I hear you talking about, you know, the failure to introduce this other evidence. How is that consistent?
This is a very good question. The judge called it an omnibus hearing on the whole damages issue. And she said, we'll hear your motion for summary judgment, and we'll hear whatever they want to say about their damages. We'll hear all of it. So it was like, and I think she calls it that, an omnibus hearing.
And reopened the record?
Yes. Okay. And so the record was, I supplemented the record with the stuff I got about BCT Inc. Mm-hmm. And she made conclusions about that. So the record was open. I mean, if it's open, have at it. Say whatever you want to say. Get whatever expert you want to say. I see my time is up.
Well, if you don't mind, I just would, have you completed your answer to that question? Because I just find procedurally this is unusual. I mean, she doesn't talk about an omnibus hearing. She talks about summary judgment, which would, you know, to my mind, exclude consideration of new evidence.
The prior transcripts show that it was contemplated as an omnibus hearing. Mm-hmm. We called it that, an omnibus hearing. So my position would be, in the alternative, summary judgment or more evidence. Or if they wanted to add more evidence, or if they wanted to supplement it before then, I would say, in not directly on point, but pleading in the alternative, or entertaining the case or listening to the case in the alternative. I'll listen to everything here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll turn to attorney for respondent. There are 15 minutes on the clock. Please remember to introduce yourself and your client. And you can certainly adjust the podium if you want to, but you may begin when you are ready.
I think this is okay. Bradley Hendrickson on behalf of the respondent, Tesfaye Shakir. And Your Honor, if I may just pick up from the procedural standpoint, I do think it's unusual. And I was reading the transcripts, you know, post-trial this morning, and I didn't see the omnibus quotes. I understood it to be that it was a summary judgment motion, and therefore the affidavit of the plaintiff was submitted, the memorandums were submitted. So I understood it to be a summary judgment motion and not reopening up the trial to new evidence.
Your Honor. Although she clearly comments in her order about this entity that was discovered, BCT, and that was new to the record.
Yes, Your Honor, it certainly was. And, you know, based upon the findings of the court, I think it's supported by the evidence that was submitted. The main evidence here in this case was that Mr. Shakir was the lessee. He was the purchaser. He was on the hook for all this, and therefore, he is the proper party. And, you know, with regard to the other evidence that he filed, the S Corporation, everything was reported on his own taxes. It was a pass-through entity. But again, the main evidence that the trial court relied upon was that Mr. Shakir is on the lease. He's on the purchase.
He had... As you just mentioned, the S Corporation was supposedly reflected in his own tax returns. Were those submitted into evidence?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Just with regard to the last affidavit, with regard to the summary judgment motion, there was the affidavit of Mr. Shakir along with the memorandum, and then the affidavit of the trial attorney for Mr. Shakir.
So what evidence can you point to in the record that we can look to see what the valuation of the business was before the breach, other than the purchase agreement?
Your Honor, the evidence of record is the purchase price of the business. And I know we've talked about, or I've heard what could have been submitted or, you know, should have been submitted according to appellant. But again, the standard here is what was submitted in the record, and, you know, does it support the trial court's findings and conclusions?
Can you respond to the point that your opposing counsel made then? So in the first appeal, it was remanded specifically for determination of, one, the date of the breach of the lease, two, the appropriate amount of damages incurred at the time of the breach, which must in turn be based on, three, the value of the business before the breach and after the breach. And so there wasn't enough in the record before. Why wasn't anything added on remand?
Well, what I think the remand was for the trial court to process the information. What was the evidence of record? And we can go to the kind of the two cases that I think are kind of on point that we're dealing with in this case. It's the Teach Out v. Wilson case, and then the Larson View Lakeview case, Lakeview Lofts. And so those two cases. And I think in the first opinion here, the Court of Appeals cites the Teach Out case. Okay, and that is the main case here that we're dealing with about, you know, the value of the business at or near the time of the breach. And that's the key here. And I think, you know, we need to be a little bit careful with these two cases and the standard that we're reviewing them with. I think in the first opinion, I think Teach Out was cited, but I think it's a quote from the Larson case. And so I just want to be very particular with the standard of what the trial court here needs to do. They're in the position to try to, they're the fact finder assessing the value. And unless that is just beyond the bounds of the evidence submitted, it shouldn't be disturbed. But looking at the Teach House case, or the Teach Out case, that's what we're keying on here, that the Court of Appeals in that case said that the evidence didn't support the district court's valuation of the business 2.5 years after the breach. And so it's kind of the reverse situation in that case. So we had a purchase of a gas station where we have the contract, and that's what was breached, but then Teach Out didn't sell it until 2.5 years later, or Wilson didn't. And the court held that they couldn't use that value 2.5 years later to establish the baseline. What the court didn't say was that they couldn't use it. Reviewing the facts of that case, basically what happened was Wilson testified that between the contract, when it was breached, and when he sold it, he made significant investments in the property. And so the court really held in that case was that the district court couldn't use that value because it's not supported by the facts in the case, because Wilson specifically testified he put substantial improvements in there. And so it wasn't supported. Again, then flash forward to Larson. You know, it doesn't necessarily cite that, but really the standard here is, does the evidence support the value? And so what Larson does is just gives the trial court kind of the guidelines here. We need a baseline of when the breach, what the value was at the time of the breach. And so Larson, again, in that case, the district court didn't have a baseline. And so, again, it's just instructing the trial court what they have to do to establish the baseline at the time of the breach, what does the evidence support at that time. And in our case, there's no bright line rule that it has to be at the time of the breach or what it means by near the time of the breach.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Given the standard of review here, I can see an argument that the purchase price was sufficient. It's some evidence in the record to support the district court's determination of the pre-breach value of the business. What's more troubling for me right now is what is the evidence in the record, particularly given the dispute that there was a constructive eviction from the premises, that the value of the business after the breach was zero. I mean, that seems like a bigger problem for your client. Can you explain to me why it's not?
Yes, Your Honor. And so the district court recites the facts and the findings here that this was a continuing breach. And the first opinion really cites the facts, and over the course of the years, that there were leaks right after the start of this, continuing on during the year. There was a mediated agreement that was reached that was never fulfilled by appellant. There was notice by the city to go in and shut this down, but flash forward to January of 2019, that is when there was no heat in the premises. And so the business had to shut down. And that's what the trial court relies upon here, is that we have a lease premises that has no heat, and he had to shut down the business. And that the value of the business at that time is zero. And looking at all this, I mean, the lease and the convenience store, it's all tied to this premises. That's the location, Rich's Superette's location there. But the facts of this cannot be overlooked. And in the trial court is certainly reviewing these facts of over all this time that there are leaks. And there's, you know, I will highlight that there is nothing of the record, no exhibits showing what, if anything, the appellant ever did to try to fix. I know that the trial.
Even if there was a continuing breach, didn't you guys have the burden to put information in about the amount of inventory that could have been sold or offloaded, or equipment that could have been recouped, so that there could have been some kind of calculation as to value recouped from the sale, and then, you know, there would at least be a follow-up number then to compare to the purchase price?
Your Honor, that certainly could have been evidence in there, but I would assert that, you know, this was the purchase price, you know, of the business that the trial court relied upon. And so that was the business, the value that the trial court weighed the evidence and put on. When there was no heat in the premises, the business simply couldn't go on. And this is...
It couldn't, but wouldn't you agree that there was theoretically something of value there that could have been sold off to mitigate damages?
The evidence in the record, Your Honor, of that is, it just goes, I think it's Exhibit G that appellant submitted, but it just shows that this is a business that is kind of constant keeping inventory. You know, part of the record is the leaks coming in and destroying, you know, these type of the inventory in there. But it's a business that just has to keep its inventory to be able to sell. At the end, when there's no heat in here, there's nothing that the business can sell, the business shuts down. And so the trial court put a zero value, agreed that the business could not sell anything and was worth zero and shut down.
And would you agree that it was the burden of the plaintiff respondent here to establish damages?
It's the plaintiff's burden to establish damages. And I don't believe there's an issue of that the plaintiff has been damaged. He's certainly been damaged. And I do cite some case law in here. It's not that. It's to what extent has he been damaged? And he bought the business for the purchase price. Ongoing with regard to the the lease, the leaks occur and the business is shut down. And so the trial court is weighing the evidence here, and for what evidence there is with regard to the value of the business, all the way up to Excel putting the shutdown, you know, notice on here, that's the evidence supporting the trial court's determination of what the damages are.
So explain to me why we shouldn't conclude that the district court's reliance on the purchase agreement price was too speculative to for us to defer to that decision.
Again, looking at the Teachout case and the Larson case, I mean, I think it's appropriate for the trial court to look at the value. And there's, like you said, there's different ways to value different property. But in this particular case, the purchase price is certainly one indication of the value of the business. And it's not speculative what they paid for it. The trial court said there was no other evidence, you know, indicating, just like Teachout, the opposite of Teachout, that there wasn't any other investment in there or loss that was affecting the value of the business at that time. So it would be appropriate to use the purchase price of the company.
Can I ask you, so what do we do with what we said in the first time, the decision, the first time the case was here? How do you say your client's last name again?
Shakir.
Shakir. And Shakir won, where we said that because the district court denied the claim for future damages in the form of lost profits for 2016 and 2017, that's irreconcilable with the idea that the value of the business carried over from the purchase price to the time of the breach. And so on remand, I don't understand how the district court's order dealt with that problem. I mean, that we presumed, based on the denial of those claims for lost profits in 2016 and 2017, that there was no value in the business during those years between the time that the business opened and the time of the breach. So can you help me understand how the district court order this time dealt with that concern that we had last time?
Yeah, Your Honor, I don't believe the district court addressed the future profits. That wasn't on remand, so it didn't assert that the profits and expenses going forward were attributed to the value here. It was as a result of the consequential damages due to the breaches of the lease. And so the trial court just assessed what that value was at or near the time of the breach, and then concluded up till the business was terminated with the shutdown, and at that point the value was zero. And so again, the record didn't support any other, you know, loss of the business, as the trial court cites. And so again, the value carrying forward from near the time of the breach to the very end when it was shut down, Your Honor.
Okay, and you are out of time. Do you want to make a brief concluding statement?
Well, I did just want to add too that as the trial court noted before, and I believe the first court of opinion, that the prevailing party is part of the attorney fees. Mr. Shakir was the prevailing party. The security deposit was also awarded as part of that. That part was not appealed, Your Honor.
So. Okay, thank you. And we will turn back to counsel for appellant. You have 5 minutes, and you can begin when you are ready.
Some of these cases he went through, he said, like, Wilson testified in that I think it was the Teachout case and so forth, where you have this question of people, what's occurring is people are testifying, and there's some stuff where people are talking about the damages.
Can you clarify, in the Teachout case, it seemed to me that the issue was that there wasn't a starting number in terms of the valuation of the business. The sale 2.5 years later couldn't be compared to anything. Is that right?
I think it is like the reverse, the reverse of this type of situation. But the general principle I was citing it for is that people were talking about, you know, what about what the value of the business was. Here we only have the one number, the value. So the value that we got when we initially from the district court was around $136,000. And then on remand, we get the same amount of money, presumably the same thing. And the whole reason for the remand is that there wasn't a basis for that kind of damages. And there simply is no evidence here about $136,000 to zero, because presumably there's something there. There could have been a lot of things that could have been done about one way to value a business is to take the tax returns, at least at a minimum, the tax returns, so somebody can take a look at it to substantiate their damages. They didn't even put that in the record. So a quick way to value a business that somebody could do, you've probably seen this before, is people, you get an expert or somebody that's knowledgeable about business to take a look at the tax returns to see what the value of the business was. So presumably in a case like this, we would see tax returns, some amount of money, and then some, maybe zero, decreasing amount of money. We don't even have that. We have no, absolutely nothing other than just a bare assertion that it went to zero to support the conclusion that it is zero. On the issue of the attorney's fees, we ask that this court reverse and don't remand, just reverse and zero them and don't award any attorney's fees. The opportunity was there on remand to build up their case, to present some sort of documentation, and to bear their burden. The burden isn't just look at that, what I had again, look at that amount of money I had before, I'm carrying my burden, give me the same thing. The burden was we're carrying a burden. We tried to at least carry some sort of a burden to rebut what they might say, which is why we engaged in discovery.
How could we do that, though? Even if we agree with you on the damages for the lost business value, I mean, he just pointed out that the security deposit was returned. So in that way, his client's the prevailing party, at least it's the security deposit, right? And so shouldn't there be some lodestar analysis on remand just at least as to the security deposit and the attorney's fee?
Just litigating for the security deposit?
I mean, assuming that's the case, even if we agree with you, because you didn't appeal the security deposit award. Is that right?
I'm just dealing with the remand order, so I didn't. I appealed all of their damages that they awarded.
Including the?
Yes, everything was included in my appeal. Deposit. Yes. When I appealed initially and got my remand, that was appealing the whole order. That was appealing everything. And then, you know, they didn't say anything about their security deposit here. There was no offset about the security deposit either. There was no discussion on their part about the security deposit on the remand, which if that was part of their damage, because when we were remand, that judgment was vacated. So there wasn't like still a judgment for a security deposit. There was a remand on damages. So we would maintain the position that, you know, you're not entitled to the security deposit. We ask that it be reversed and that the matter be dismissed. I have nothing further.
Okay, thank you. Seeing no further questions, I want to thank both counsel for your briefing and for the argument here today. It's been helpful. And the case is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. And with that, that concludes our calendar on our oral argument cases today. And we are recessed or convened. Thank you.
All rise.